This is a Vantage House production.
Hi folks, welcome back. This is part two of my conversation with Makovey Neal, the executive editor of the Haitian Times. I hope you enjoy.
This island, it's shared.
Yes.
One side, it's booming. It's what, probably the largest economy in the Caribbean. The other side of the island going through really, really extraordinary tough times. I would hate that it would just all be kind of like this racial animus. It can't be like, oh, they're black, we don't want to help them. Or it can't be like, oh, they speak French, we speak Spanish, we don't want to help them. Can you help me break this down? Your proximity to this so much, you know, more intense than what I have. What's happening here?
The feud between the Dominican Republic and Haiti goes back to before either country was an independent state. Mm. It is pre-colonial. A lot of the conflict we're seeing now dates back to colonial powers invading each side of the island and kind of just using both sides, right? Because Haiti belonged to the French before independence. The Dominican Republic belonged to Spain before they actually were occupied by Haiti and declared their independence from Haiti in 1844. And so there's always been this fear that of a Haitian invasion is how we've had scholars who study this relationship explain it to us. And a lot of this fear is manufactured by people in power who understand that it's easier to get people to do what you want inside your own country, speaking of the Dominican Republic, if you can point the finger to the neighbor as the source of all your ills. Okay? Mm-hmm. So a lot of that we hear happens like from the cradle, right? Where Dominicans are just taught to be suspect by Haitians. These like, you know, darker bodies coming in from the other side. Okay. And one of the worst moments in that history between the two countries was the Trujillo massacre that took place in the 1930s. I'm gonna try to get the right date for you, Kaylin, where it was unintentional ethnic cleansing that happened. Up until that point, Haitians and Dominicans kind of just had their lives at the border, right? And independent of what was going on politically, folks still intermingled, and you had some people who were born on the Haiti side, others who were born on the Dominican side, where it wasn't like that black and white. But with Trujillo and the ethnic cleansing that happened, essentially, is where we had the very definitive, okay, but like the racial aspect of it became so dominant, right? We also had the meddling of foreign powers like the U.S. in their, you know, neo-colonial way that was striking deals between, brokering deals between Duvalier and on the Haiti side and Trujillo and his government on the Dominican side to have Haitians go work the land in the Dominican Republic. So the Dominican Republic could meet its quotas for different exports it was supposed to send abroad and sell to the US and Europe at specific prices because of the cheap labor it was getting from Haiti. So it gets very complicated how these migrations we see back and forth across the border with, you know, Haitians being told to go work there. And the Dominican Republic depends on Haitian labor for building out that country, like all those resorts that we're seeing, the high rises going up, you know, the like retail, like restaurant, food, labor, all of that, a lot of it is on the back of Haitian labor, but we're not recognized generally as having any rights to, you know, have a say in Dominican Republic government or any of that. Even with this canal that I mentioned, because we saw a flare up happen where patients were saying, we need to build a new canal to irrigate farmland that's on our side of the island. So we're going to go for it, because it had been agreed and had started just before Jovenel Moïse was assassinated. That work stopped after the assassination, along with a lot of other things that stalled, right? And the folks in Haiti in the fall of 2023 decided to just start rebuilding the canal because they needed access to water for farms, irrigation, you know, for potable water, all of these things. The Dominican Republic objected, and it turned into a whole thing where the border ended up being shut down, right, officially. But did that mean there was no migration back and forth? No, it just made it easier for smugglers to get people across, to get guns across, and to get drugs across the border.
Is the Dominican Republic a source for a lot of the illegal weaponry that the gangs are using?
That's what we've heard and seen. Yeah. This border is, I forget exactly how many miles it is, but it is.
We're talking hundreds of miles.
It's very porous too, right?
Yeah.
It's, I'm going to get this number for you because I think it's important. It goes all the way from the north to the south of the island. Haiti is on the one third. The West, Dominican Republic occupies two-thirds in the east. And up and down the island, you have canals, you have waterways, you have forests, very thick forests, right? There are only like three or four official crossings at the border. That means all the rest of it is open and people come in and out all the time.
Crazy mountains and crazy forests.
Terrain. Yeah. So it's a source. And Haitians have long said, you know, they have to recognize that and do more and better and actually stop the flow of these weapons coming into Haiti. But you also have folks coming in by boats on the other side of the island, on like the southwest side of Haiti, to bring in these guns and drugs, Latin America, from South America, through the seaport, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the guns were also flown down through small planes and private airstrips that people with money own and operate on their own, you know? So yes, the Dominican Republic border with Haiti is one source for a lot of the smuggling, but so has the privatized ports and access points that the government doesn't run. People with money in Haiti have run historically. It's geopolitics. What's different now is that we can see in real time how decisions that have been made in a vacuum or at the State Department in DC or at the UN, you know, headquarters actually play out. We're watching it in real time because the world is becoming smaller with digital communication, with people being able to be live, you know, and show what's going on. And because we've had the type of media manipulation I'm talking about with the gangs using it to their advantage, right? It's just all coming together so fast and we're witnessing it. You know, unfortunately, not much of this is different from what we've seen before. It just feels more heightened. And obviously it's more urgent now because Haiti has no government at all to speak of.
Yeah. I'm still blown away that there are no remaining elected officials in Haiti. That is mind-blowing. I want to shift a little bit to the responsibilities that you think the U.S. and France has to Haiti and how they should be showing up better to try to make things right. Blown away, I think for the last episode was the first time that I had known that Haiti had been paying billions of dollars in reparations to France just up until the 1940s. Mm-hmm. That blows my mind. I can't believe that France hasn't tried to rectify that and correct that. I'm ashamed, kind of like as an American, that it was our U.S. banks who facilitated these payments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now we like to think of ourselves as like these socially woke, you know, we're these modern governments and we care about people and, you know, the global whatever. I don't hear anything about any type of like development plans from the US or France for Haiti. Not saying that they should go as far as like send troops to kind of like do the stabilization. I don't even think Haitians probably want French or American troops. I'm sure they don't want any troops, but is there a place for France and the US to assist?
I think so, yes. No, I think a lot of Haiti's problems are a direct result of the neocolonialist, you know, policies you mentioned, right? This debt that Haiti had to pay, this ransom, as it's often called, right? Or having to take in products from the US that would just overflow agricultural products that then just destabilize Haiti's own agricultural sector, you know? I think over time, things like this build up when you know you have repressive regimes in place, or you know politicians are corrupt and squandering the aid money or development money that's out there, but you keep propping them up. So I think it is, the U.S. does have a debt to pay to Haiti now in helping to stabilize it. Does that? We're debating, but I think we have to be realistic as Haitians, okay? I don't see a scenario where the Haitian National Police as a force is able to clean up these gangs in Haiti on its own, or these gangs in Port-au-Prince on its own. It's not possible from what we know and have seen about the different tactics they've tried before that haven't worked, and where we are now, where literally the gangs are moving forward and trying to capture the National Palace. Okay? So the way the U.S. has been approaching it from sort of like a trying to maintain a distance, right, for political reasons, which as Americans we can understand, an election year coming, the U.S. is extremely polarized, right? Not just from like Republican, Dominican like ideologies, but just in the everyday now, people are just so polarized, right? Everything is politicized. And for that reason, I don't see it being the face of any sort of intervention in Haiti. It's just not politically expedient, right? And I think that's why they try to go the route of like strong arming countries like Kenya, diplomatically strong arming them into taking the lead, because I think Haiti doesn't help to essentially put out the fire, right? If we use that neighbor analogy again, if your house is on fire, you can't fight that fire from the inside. We have to bring in people from the outside to put out, to extinguish the flames, you know? And so think about it that way. How it does that is the moment that we're in right now. But with falling, where the U.S. is falling, I think, on its role, and it's paying back its dues to Haiti, it's still using the old playbook of playing politics in the region, instead of being more forthright and forthcoming with what it's doing and why it can't be them, but it has to be someone else. What you'll hear is the State Department say things like it has to be a Haitian-led solution, right? But the Haitian-led, quote-unquote, solutions that have been presented, they haven't gone anywhere. They've stalled primarily because the U.S. hasn't said, okay, they haven't signed off. You know, they haven't signed off, or the minute they told Ariel Henry he had to go, they found a place for him in Puerto Rico to sit and wait for this council, right? So I think the U.S. has to prioritize Haiti, not for another military engagement, but in changing the playbook so that the folks who are on the presidential council and just still playing the same old games of fighting each other and delaying this entire process and dragging it out so that Barbecue and friends have time to get to the National Palace. We've had a month now of really no action since the announcement, right? So I think the way the U.S. has to prioritize Haiti is to say, okay, we can't keep doing it the same way we've done it before, but we are still respected. We are still the superpower in the region. And so we do need to make approach this differently in a way where we're not being played again by some of these folks of special interest who are taking part in the political process. And that's not happening. I also think the U.S. needs to address the immigration aspects.
Oh, that's perfect. That's my next question.
Do you want to go ask it so you have a break?
Yeah. No, I'm wondering, has there been kind of like a shift in the way the U.S. is handling Haitian migrants? They were deporting folks, you know, before kind of like this recent breakdown, they were deporting folks back to Haiti, which seemed nuts. Like, why are you deporting folks back? Are they still deporting folks back to Haiti? I mean, is it possible?
Not in recent weeks. Like, I've heard of one-off cases here and there, but not at the level of the number of flights we used to see of, you know, deportations every day. I mean, you can't even get flights into Haiti.
Right. Yeah.
So how would you even do it, right? To even leave Haiti, there's only one working airport right now. The tickets are skyrocketing. You have to use helicopters to airlift people out and all of that. So, but the deportation, at least for now, isn't a major concern right now. What we have seen the U.S. do over the past 2 years, kind of right around the time Ariel Henry was getting, the gangs were picking up the pace of kidnapping, we started seeing the Biden administration extend and expand TPS to apply to more people. TPS is temporary protected status, which was, you know, a program initially initiated under the Obama administration after the 2010 earthquake that killed, you know, some 200,000, not more people. So that's been extended to include folks who were in the country over and over again. It's been extended to basically apply to people who were in the U.S. as of like November 2022. But all of those programs, when you're part of them, you have to go through a renewal process. So we do have advocates who are calling for those to be made permanent, right? And not just temporary. And we've also seen the very popular Biden program, the humanitarian parole program that people refer to as the Biden program, that allows up to 33,000 people a month to enter through the border over 2 years, right? So this launched in January 2023. And so we've gone through the 1 year mark, and we're not sure if there'll be a change, but, you know, obviously, it's been a political talking point that comes up over and over again. But I think that type of shift of recognizing that Haiti needs help, it doesn't all have to be military help. It can be through the migration policy, because a lot of the reasons people are migrating out of Haiti is because of policies the U.S. has engineered or supported over time that precipitated the country falling into this decline. So I think that's a step in the right direction that the U.S. needs to do more of. But the urgency we're talking about right now is that it can't take its eye off the ball when it comes to Haiti. If we have a presidential council that's being formed, led by CARICOM or anyone else, there really should have been a deadline to say, okay, you have a week to do it, instead of this a limit. Like, how do you have a plan? How do you have a goal and not have it be time bound? It doesn't make any sense. It's just, you know, very elementary goal setting. You have to have a time to do it by. So they can learn from that mistake, is what I'm calling it, of just letting these people take their sweet time while folks continue to die, to be killed, to be kidnapped in Haiti. Like, it's not happening.
Brought this up earlier. This is a complete subject change. So you brought up earlier about some of the folks on social media who are kind of like going to Haiti and, like, you know, doing like these adventure things. I want to talk about this one that recently happened. Addison Pierre, your fellow Arab Malouf, who, yeah, I know, same. I was actually on your site, and he's this YouTuber, goes to dangerous places, tries to interact with the local gangs or whoever, creates content from it, and then leaves. This time in Haiti, gets kidnapped and spends 2 weeks there. I guess his family pays a ransom. He's finally released. Doesn't help the situation at all.
It doesn't help at all. And I've been working on an opinion piece about this that I think it might come out on Monday or Tuesday.
Okay. But
what I see in this situation is the way that different people manage to profit off of Haiti's misfortunes every time, every single time. You know, if it's not certain business interests or industries that are profiting off of Haiti's misfortunes to, you know, congressional trade deals and whatnot, right? NGOs that are contributing to destabilizing the country and charging consultant fees, right, to help Haiti build up, where the majority of the budget goes to administration and consulting salaries instead of to meet the actual need in Haiti, right? So now I'm looking at this. Another classic example is the way that the airlines actually jack up their prices every time there's an issue with Haiti.
And like the most desperate of times.
The most desperate of times, you know?
Yeah.
They'll triple, quadruple their prices instead of doing the humane thing of saying, all right, people are desperately trying to get out. Let's have more flights. Let's do whatever. Okay, yes, we might be able to have a small increase, but come on, 3-4 times, it's unconscionable.
Yeah.
It's furious. And so this, the media side too, traditional legacy media, I see this, and it also boggles my mind when I see top tier or tier one journalism outlets give voice to people like Barbecue, you know, when they let Gipsy Lee, the convicted money launderer who was just released from U.S. prison in November, he went back to Haiti and decided to use the Haiti's environmental group for his purposes to also march into the capital. This guy ends up on the front pages the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and it's like, come on, you guys. This is part of the game where they try to find a way to be part of the conversation. They are distracting from what's really happening with Haiti and trying to find a way to drive a narrative that is not true so they could be on radar, so they could be part of the discussions, right, that are taking place at the UN and the State Department. So I just really wish there was more discernment on the side of the our top media outlets in making these decisions. Just like I wish YouTube would have better content moderation when it comes to folks like your fellow Arab making money off of Haiti. It's not okay.
I totally agree. I like to end these things asking people what makes them hopeful for the future. So if you kind of were looking ahead, you had your crystal ball, and you could say, okay, Chaylin, this is what makes me hopeful. This is something that I'm excited about to see in Haiti. What would that be?
I think it would be the grassroots local efforts that we're seeing out of Haiti. I mentioned before that people outside of the capital of Port-au-Prince have always had to figure out how to live without necessarily waiting for Port-au-Prince. And I think now more than ever, it's feeling like it's clear they have to be more visible and more bold in their actions. Because right now, for all intents and purposes, Port-au-Prince doesn't really exist governmentally. And it's going to take a while to either get it under control or to rebuild it. What gives me hope is seeing how, for example, we still have many people in the diaspora or who care about Haiti who are supporting some of those projects there, right? Knowing that it may not be the long-term solution, but those efforts help prop up the country. They don't get enough attention, but that goes a long way in actually making sure that not all, you know, 12 million patients end up leaving the country. We still have millions and millions of people who are proud, who are happy, who love their land. It's a beautiful country. No one wants to leave it unless they're forced to. And so I would want to keep supporting those efforts there and not just focus so much on what's happening in the capital when we think about Haiti and like what we can do, you know, people who are Haitian or not Haitian, right? Your listeners, for example. I think there's opportunity to help to get to know Haiti differently, to help understand it, its history and its current state and future differently. And a lot of that is by tuning our ear to what's happening outside the capital, even as we're trying to push for an ultimate solution to the government aspect of the state.
I really love the grassroots part of it. I feel like, you know, when kind of like the overhead has kind of crashed down, there's still that sense of community out there that is keeping things going and running. So I think that I would second that. I think that would be something to make me hopeful as well. Mac, thank you so much for coming on The Delve. I think this might be a two-parter because every time we start talking about Haiti, it's just such a rich conversation. You just can't get out of it. Yeah. So thanks so much again for coming on. This was incredible. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you guys for listening in. Once again, if you're looking for a way to help, I've listed some awesome organizations in the show notes. I'm Jalen. This is The Delve. I'll catch you next time.